Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I refrain from using the boys and girls because there may be a few boys and girls out there listening, begging the parents to change the channel quickly. That guy is talking. I know this because I have a 3-year-old daughter who begs my wife occasionally, I want to hear Dado talking on the radio. She turns it on. I talk for 30 seconds and my daughter says, okay, that's enough. So good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and I'm Jake McClure. Usually, I'm joined by my father, Jeff McClure, who is driving back from Colorado today with a beautiful Airstream trailer being pulled behind him. They go out and enjoy vacations multiple times a year, and this time around is Colorado. Happens once a year at this time. It's kind of they go back to the place where they proposed to each other, my mom and dad. It's very sweet. So what that means is I'm flying solo today. I've got a lot to talk about. Good stuff, bad stuff, just stuff. It's kind of hard to put a good or a bad on information, but I think it's all useful, which would make even the bad stuff good stuff. All right, so what's happened this week? Well, let me give a disclosure first. The Personal Wealth Coach is also an investment advisory firm registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that they've given us any thumbs up or thumbs down. It just means that they're our regulatory authority, and we're required to talk about it when we talk about the firm that we worked with. Jeff and I, my dad and I, are the principals at that firm, and we also do this program. Why are we doing this program? Well, there is definitely some benefit to us by doing the program. We don't get paid for doing it, but our name gets out there. But the underlying reason why we do this program, why we've given up many, many, many Saturday mornings, is to inform you guys. There is no good structured way that exists that I know of for the public to be well informed on finance. There's a lot of bias that gets in the way. If you're being informed on finance from someone who's going to profit greatly at your information, you might get a little bias in there. Maybe good bias, maybe bad bias, but I'd rather at least give you all the tools to do the research yourself. I think it makes a better community, better informed public. The better informed we are, the better the decisions we make. I still honestly believe that, even with the politics the way we do, well-informed people are rare. But if you're listening to this program, you at least want to be. Hopefully. Either that or you just enjoy listening to a strange bald man talk Saturday mornings. I hope you have better things to do if that's the only reason why you're doing it. I wouldn't listen to me as a strange bald man, hopefully, for the information, though. So what's happened this week? Well, the S&P 500, this is the stock index that we look at most regularly because it's more because it's popular than because we think it's great and accurate for all kinds of information. It's a good metric to look at some kind of average movements of the stock market. So what's happened this week with the S&P 500? It's up 1.16% for the week. It closed at 2,904. That's above the 2,900 mark. It's not as high as it was at the end of August, but it's above the 2,900 point. There's lots of bad news out there. And the market still went up. What does that mean? There's lots of good news out there, too. But there was a time, I think you can all remember it, wasn't that long ago, that any bad news caused the market to drop. And good news rarely caused it to go up. That just means that we're in a different bit of the cycle of the market. Let's see, what else is going on? The 10-year U.S. Treasury note, that's what we use to look at bonds in general, just as a statement, because they are generally pretty safe if you hold them to maturity. They're guaranteed by the government. If you sell them on the secondary market, you can lose some money. If you hold them to maturity, we've got a guarantee from the government in the Constitution that says that they're going to pay. It the interest rate on the 10-year Treasury is almost at 3%. When I say almost, I mean really almost. I mean 3/1,000ths of a percentage point away from being at 3%. It's at 2.997%. That's, you know, we could round that. Let's call it a 3. It's a good thing because the 2-year Treasury climbed to 2.782%. 2-year Treasury, 10-year Treasury, when they're that close together, that means that the yield curve is very flat. We are looking at things that if the short-term rate comes up just a tiny amount and the long-term rate comes down just a tiny amount, we have what's called an inverted yield curve, which means that you could make more money giving short-term loans than giving long-term loans. That's not a good sign for the health of the economy in the future. So where we are now, and we're not triggering any alarms, but we're right on the line. There's a line on the ground, and it's kind of like if you tell a 3-year-old to stay in your room, don't come out of your room, and they stand right at the edge of it. Well, they're not in trouble yet. So that's where we are in the economy. We can talk about more on that later. The 30-year mortgage, and we watch this on a regular basis, the average 30-year mortgage being offered today is running at 4.68%. Last year, just 1 year ago, it was at 3.83%. What does this mean? Well, it's causing housing starts to come down. It's causing automobile purchases to drop because automobile loans are up about 1% from where they were last year as well. It gets more expensive to buy things, which is a downward pressure on the prices of the cars and the houses. Or we have inflation. So this, when we're looking around at this, it means that we are at a roaring high point in an economy. It could go higher. I'm not saying this is the top. But when we look at these numbers, it means that we are doing extremely well right now. And anybody that's listened to us for any period of time says, if you're doing really well, you've heard us say this, if you're doing really well, you should sock some money away. Don't spend it all. Don't get in more debt than you've ever been in your life at the top. You want to do your expansion when things are cheap, which means you wait for the downturn. That's just the reality of good business decisions. There's this enthusiasm, this euphoria that comes on when things are going well to take on more debt, to buy things you can barely afford. If you're at the top of your earning cycle right now and you buy something that you can barely afford, you may be in trouble in a few years if things go the other way. At some point, things are not going to be great. At some point, we have recessions. It's not like they stopped. So we're going to have more recessions in the future. We're in a great spot now. Let's plan for the bad times when it's the best time to do it. Right now, when things are great. Hopefully you all have excesses coming in, that you're getting paid more than you have before. Definitely, on average, people are in that position. So prep for the bad times when you're in the good times. And if you're going to take on debt, you need to go through your savings in the downturn and then take on that debt. If you have a great business opportunity and you look at it and it's great even in a downturn, it's still a good idea to take that business opportunity. Okay, so there's a pretty unanimous consensus around economists that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise short-term rates for banks. The interbank lending rate is likely to come up another 0.25% the next time they meet. Which, again, were 2-year treasuries 0.25% or less below the 10-year. Hopefully we get some rising in the long-term rates as well. All right, we got a caller coming in. Well, I was about to change subjects, but I will take the caller. Caller on 773-1400, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to give you a show idea, because I think it would take at least two hours to discuss this, and you guys seem to be, you know, somewhat fair and balanced, although I don't always agree with you, but most of the time I do. If you were to go back and put your thinking cap on and say, okay, back in the election that Trump won, we had a person running against him, Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
You know what her strategies were.
Yep.
You know what Trump's strategies are.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to go back and do a guesstimate of what the U.S. economy would look like today had Hillary been elected, and what we might see different other than the fact that nobody would be talking about Russia and nobody would be doing an investigation. You know, it'd be interesting to understand what we think, because I know it's not perfect. You can't really
right.
project things like that. But what would be different? Because we wouldn't have a tax cut.
Right.
You know, we wouldn't probably Obamacare would still be just like it was before. So, you know, it's not something that you can do probably without preparing, but someday maybe you guys could go back and kind of give that a 20-30 minute section or something, okay?
Okay. Thank you for the call. And I'm going to hit a little bit of that right now. So appreciate the call. I recommend highly that to get some context on this, people go back to, well, go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got podcasts from the radio program. If you go to the radio program and you look at the election season, look at from September up to November of 2016, even before that, you'll see that, or hear, that I did some pretty clear analysis of the proposals from both candidates. I also did some pretty clear analysis of what the market and the economy were doing in the election year. We had a big flat period in the market. The economy was still growing, but it was kind of with bated breath waiting to see what happened during the election. If Hillary Clinton had been elected, I think we would have had status quo. We would have had not much different from when Obama was in office. And that means that we had a slowly growing economy. No big tax cuts, no massive earning growth because of the tax cut, but good earning growth. Last week I mentioned something about the lagging economic indicators. We usually talk about the leading economic indicators. And the leading indicators predict. They say these items that are happening have a predictive effect. And the lagging indicators say this is what's just happened. And we had a drop in our lagging indicators. Even though we had a really, really good quarter last quarter of 4.2% growth in the gross domestic product, the indicators for the underlying economy dropped. We're seeing some of that in the durable goods and orders and so on in the leading indicators, but the lagging indicators dropped, which means that the only reason why we didn't have a little dip in our GDP last quarter is because we had a lot of cash suddenly hit. So that wouldn't have happened had Hillary Clinton been elected. I think the year of 2017, not a lot as far as the economy or the market would be different had Hillary Clinton been elected. And you can hear us talking about why that is on the programs leading up to the election. Because the economy was in great shape and set to leap. Now, what we've had this year, 2018, is largely due to tax cuts. It's large. The earnings growth that we've had is largely due to tax cuts. Now, we still would have had earnings growth. The market is doing well, but not stellarly well this year compared to last year. And the reason is because we're not getting the same kind of earnings growth that we've been prepped for a while. So we predicted before we knew who was running for office that 2017 was going to be a really great year, because all of the indicators were laid out in that way. So, you know, Hillary Clinton right now would be trumpeting her success in the economy. And it's kind of great segue, by the way, caller. Thank you for the call. And we'll do a larger segment on it at another time. It's a great segue because I had some things lined up to talk about that really don't have to do with this era at all. It has to do with the words that we use to describe the market and why we so often say that the economy is rarely truly long-term or short-term affected very much by who's president. It has a lot more to do with business cycles and with trade. In this case, the Trump administration has stepped in and done a lot on the trade side, which has a lot to do with the business cycle. And going back to Bill Clinton, he also did some things that affected the trade cycle that didn't happen during his administration. So NAFTA was signed under his administration, but the slow expansion that we've seen in the business across the three countries didn't happen while Bill Clinton was in office. Happened slowly there, just the beginning of it. But you don't build hundreds of plants in Canada and in Mexico. You don't do that in a short period of time. So the changes that Donald Trump are making also aren't going to have an immediate impact, except in some pretty narrow areas. The tax cut has a big and immediate impact. That's more Congress than the president, but it wouldn't have happened without a Republican president in office, because it was a Republican tax cut. If Hillary Clinton had been in office, she would have vetoed it. So there are some things that I can look at and say these things are different. So let's take a step back. I'm going to talk about some of the words that we use, and part of the reason why I say it's hard for a president, any president, to have a major impact on the economy in a short period of time. They can have an impact in a short period of time, but the impact doesn't show until later. And this is just the way the economy works. It's so big that even major changes take a long time to implement. So I'm going to take a step back, as I said. We're going to talk about some pretty easy words that nobody talks about. First, the market. Is it fair? Bull market, bear market, secular, cycle, secular or secular, two different words for bear markets and bull markets. Okay, so is the market fair? I get asked that a lot. And a lot of people that have listened to this program for any length of time know what I'm going to say here. The market is fair because that's what the word fair means. It's the original meaning of the word fair is market. You would go to the fair. The way we think of fair today as being even and balanced, the caller said he disagreed with some of the stuff. Absolutely important to know that you do that, by the way. I hope you don't agree with everything that I say. I hope all of you have things that you disagree with, because blind faith in a given person, if that person is not a deity, is rarely a good thing. Loyalty is great. Giving support and trust is great. But if you disagree with someone, you may be able to add something to change the other person's opinion or find something in the middle that's better than both sides. Okay, so the market, just the word market, it means to write on stuff. You market. You're putting prices on things. That's it. The word fair means market. Where we get the word balanced from out of fair is that there was a licensed scale at the older fairs, the older markets. The baron or the king would license the scale, and that was the only scale that was allowed to be used at that market, at that fair, to measure money, to measure the weight of goods. It was called the fair scale or the fair market scale. And when people started negotiations on the price of pigs or green beans or barley, and it wasn't time for the market, they started at the fair market value, because that's the market value that was at the fair. You start at that negotiating point. So what is fair market value? It means the value that things traded at. Is that fair? Well, that's kind of the definition. If both people came into the deal with the same amount of information and they made a deal, then on the surface of it, that should be pretty fair. The term fair changed about 60 years after it was used as a marketplace. It started appearing in poetry and in songs. and it took on the meaning like cool. She was fair of face. I think about that as slang. Today we use letter combinations like IRL for real in the real life, or LOL for laugh out loud. They used fair for looking good. She was fair of face, or he was fair of form, when fair still meant market. He was market of face, and she was market of form. It's a little bit strange, but that's where the word came from. It was slang. To be fair of face came out before the word fair was used to mean balanced. Balanced was the third meaning of that word. So balanced is the word we use most, or the meaning we use most when we say fair. Is it fair? Is it balanced?
3 minutes, stations. 3 minutes to your next Fox News.
3 minutes. Okay, we got that thing turned off. Okay, so fair. That's what market means. Fair is market. Market is fair. If it's open, if you have an open market that no one has a monopoly on, then by definition it's fair. If there's a monopoly on it, if there is a forced purchase or sale, it is not a fair. That is a a governmental type situation. It's not at the fair. So keep that in mind when people say, well, the market's not fair, it's rigged. Well, every transaction is rigged if you're on the losing side, because the other side won. If you go in with a legal set of information and they go in with a legal set of information, you're both well informed, you know what you're going to take and no less, then you shouldn't take less than that amount. If you're going to sell something, don't take less than the amount that you think of as a fair value. Then that is a fair transaction. If somebody says, I don't care what I take, just give me something for it, and then a year later say that wasn't a fair transaction, it was. You just capitulated. You just said, give me whatever. So that's what fair means. So at the same context, same time period as fair, as a market, was a bull market and a bear market. And that had a lot more to do with the weather than it had to do with anything else. Because at the market, you were selling things that you grew, whether it be animals or barley or the barley turning into beer or any number of other things. Most of the stuff that was there was grown, whether it be spices or cloth. Well, cloth came from the sheep. That was grown. It's not like we were manufacturing plastic at the time. Basically, anything that was sold was grown, and the weather affected that, down to buttons. I have a newspaper up in the office in Salado, and it's talking about the button famine, that they were running out of clam and oyster shells to make buttons out of. This was in the early 1900s. So people were saying, how are we going to close our shirts in the future? Well, we found a way. That's how the market works. If there's a high demand, people are going to go look for that thing because they can make money on it. So a bull market or a bear market had absolutely to do with the weather, even in the name. In a great weather environment, you have a lot more bulls. The cattle are having more calves. You get more calves, you get a higher number of bulls, but you really only need one bull for your herd. You want the best one, but you only need one. So what do you do with the extra bulls? You bring them to market. And if you have a lot of bulls at market, that's called a bull market because things are going really well. Let's flip that around. The weather's not doing so well. Calves are not being born at high speed. And when they are being born, things are coming out of the woods and eating them because it's not raining a lot. And the deer and other game that's out there that the predators usually eat are dying. So the bears are coming out of the woods. And this is all stuff you can look up, by the way. This isn't just me. At that point in history, people were hired to go and trap the bears. And quite often after they would trap the bears, they would bring them to market. They would do bear baitings with dogs. They would do dancing bears. They would chain bears at the market. But when there were bears at the market, it generally meant things were bad. But you got the entertainment of watching bloody fights, I guess. I don't think we consider that entertainment anymore. and that the concept is there. Okay, this is a bear market versus a bull market. When times are great, there's more bulls. When times are bad, there's more bears. Taxation absolutely had something to do with that as well. If you had great weather, but you were being taxed so much that you couldn't prosper, then you didn't have better crops the next year than you did that year, because you couldn't afford better crops. You couldn't plant more. You couldn't reap the rewards of your own labor. So taxation has always been a part of that as well. And we throw taxation into the current market situation. It has a great benefit or detriment, depending on the current tax code. So that talks about bull and bear. This concept of doing trades in things other than what we grow, and this conceptual ownership of companies, the word company itself comes from a time period after the early 1400s in England, after the Battle of Agincourt, when Henry V and a small English army defeated a very large French army. In the process, he ennobled a lot of his army and gave them land, but didn't give them huge titles. So they owned the land and they worked the land, which was, this is one of the first times in history that that was a common practice. In England at that point, a landowner working their own land was unheard of until this. So mostly the yeomen, mostly the bowmen, the people that were pulling that English longbow, were now owners of land. And the land was not set up as the best arable land and the worst arable land. It was given in big tracts. And these big tracts were given by company, military company, because they were military. That's how they were ennobled. This is a company of archers. So they said, this is company land. And it was set up so that you got a share of that land, a share of the rewards that that land provided. You had to provide labor as well. But company land was owned by share. And that's how we look at companies today. It was a military term that became an ownership term that we now know and use today without any thought to the ownership term that used to be military. If you own share, and just as a side note, we talk about share and stock, common stock, as being the most common form of share ownership. Common stock at the beginning in England was livestock that was owned in common by the company. So when somebody says you don't know the difference between common stock and livestock, well, you can say, well, originally there wasn't any. It's the same stuff. It's owned in common by share. So when I'm talking about weather being a big influencer on the economy, it still is. For four of the last 5 years, the first quarter of the year has been a low GDP. It didn't happen this year because we had a big tax cut and we missed a hurricane. Didn't have a big hurricane at the beginning of the year. We didn't have a big snowstorm at the beginning of the year. No big weather event hit at the beginning of 2018. We're getting a big weather event right now. The Carolinas are being swamped. What will that do to the economy? Well, that's not a big center of the economy. It's not an area that when it's hit, it's going to really drag down the rest of us. But it's going to have a lowered effect on GDP for this quarter. This quarter is going to be influenced, as well as next quarter, by Florence. Florence coming through and hitting the Carolinas is a detrimental effect on the economy that may be as large as the tax cut. It's temporary, obviously, but then the effect of the tax cut is a one-time deal as well. So I've got to play some commercials. Hopefully this is not boring you all to tears, kind of bringing some historical context to it has always taken a long time for any changes to an economy to have a long-term effect, to come out with anything. Besides a change in tax code or a stimulus-type package, which is in essence what we did with raising spending at the same time that we lowered taxes. We did a stimulus. We did a stimulus at the time when the market and the economy are both doing really, really well, which anybody that's listened to us for very long, that's kind of like using steroids. It means that we don't have time to consolidate and focus our efforts. It means that everything kind of is profitable, even if it shouldn't be under normal circumstances. That's not necessarily a good thing long term. It feels great right now, though. So we're going to play some commercials. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. If you'd like to call in, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and I'll be back on the other side. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and I have a caller on 773-1400. Caller on 773-1400, you are on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, Jake, enjoy the show. Last week in the Wall Street, they had a big section on the 10-year anniversary of the financial crisis. And there was a section on mortgages, and it went into a lot of detail anyway about banks versus non-banks.
Right.
And 10 years later, it says 52% of mortgages are held by non-banks as opposed to 9% for banks.
Mm-hmm.
They said that the liar loan thing that got us into trouble, it went away, but the non-banks are really not regulated very much. I was just curious if that's a concern, number one. And then did the CDOs, is that still available, or did that go away too as a result of this? I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Appreciate it. All right. CDOs, also known as CMOs, they're collateralized debt obligations, collateralized mortgage obligations. Those still exist. Anytime you buy a Ginny Mae or Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac loan, you're buying a collateralized mortgage obligation or debt obligation. If you're talking about, for instance, car dealerships sell collateralized debt obligations on cars. It just means that there's collateral on debt. They still exist. The reason why they were a problem in the lead-up and then into the Great Recession is because of exactly what you mentioned, is the liar loans. Before I get too much into that, I'm going to go back to the first thing you said about non-banks. This is a fascinating area. Part of the problem that led us into the buildup and then the recession was that Glass-Steagall, part of Glass-Steagall, and there were multiple acts. Glass-Steagall was passed during the Depression as a way of separating investments and banks. That, to some extent, was dissolved so that investment banks and commercial banks could own each other. So a commercial bank could make a loan to you for your mortgage and then turn around and sell that asset. The mortgage itself is an asset because you're paying interest to the bank. They can sell that asset on the open market, not necessarily to a bank. And the way they do that is through the investment arm. And there's lots of examples of that. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan Chase. Those are the merging, and there's lots more than that. Those are the merging of commercial and investment banks. They're still banks at this point. But when you sell that package, that loan, on the open market, anybody can buy it. If you own a Fannie Mae loan, a bond for Fannie Mae, or any part of that in a mutual fund, you, in essence, are one of those non-banks. Now, that's not the only definition of it. There are institutions who are getting into financing that aren't going in through the normal bank channels. There's a lot of them. One kind of benign instance of it is PayPal. PayPal's not a bank. Vimeo, not a bank. You're doing transactions that sometimes holding balances, sometimes earning interest on those balances, definitely acting, tasting, smelling like a bank, except that PayPal rarely gives loans. It's a non-banking, and that's part of the reason why they're benign, is that if they were getting into loans and not following other bank procedures, that's a problem. Another one is payday loans. Those are coming from, you know, the pawn shops and car dealerships, and come in here and give me your title and I'll give you a loan. There have always been non-bank lenders out there. And if you think about one specific instance, bail bondsmen. That is something, a bond is literally a loan. When someone is arrested, this is more for the last hour, attorneys type areas, but if somebody's arrested and they have a bail that's been given, they say you've got to bring in $100,000 and we'll let you go, or $10,000 and we'll let you go. A typical bail bondsman will say, you put up 10% of that, we'll put up the rest of it. We keep that 10%. You show up at court. If you don't show up at court, we're going to come find you. So they got a 10% loan. In some cases, that loan rate is higher. A lot of municipalities and a lot of states have regulated bondsmen to say you can't overcharge. But that's not a bank, but it's giving a loan. When we look at the source of loans right now, and what the Wall Street Journal said was correct, what you were repeating was correct, the majority of loans today were not are not owned, in some cases were not issued by a bank. That's a problem. It's something that we haven't dealt with. The Dodd-Frank Act, which was supposed to solve all the woes and problems of the world, was a partisan response. Dodd and Frank were both Democrats. It was a Democrat Congress at the time. There was a lot of pressure to do something. Dodd and Frank were both instigators to the recession. They weren't the only ones. There's no way to point and say who's to blame for the recession. There were a lot of blames to go around. People, the liar loans, we called them ninjas at the time. No income, job, or assets. Ninja loans. I'm going to pay back this loan. What are you going to pay it back with? Well, maybe I'll take my kid's piggy bank. And there was a lot of that. There were liar loans where they basically just said, I have money that I don't have, or this is going to be my primary residence when it's their fourth house and they never plan on living there. They're going to rent it out or flip it. So liar loans, you're right. We have the banks were severely burned by the recession. The people that lost the most in the recession were the bankers. Now, the people that have gained the most since the recession have also been the bankers. We can't throw that out. Liar loans have multiple signatures on them. They have the signature of the people getting the loan and of the bankers. And earlier on, there were a lot more mortgage brokers. The mortgage brokerage industry basically collapsed. It was the single greatest hit of any single industry out there was the mortgage brokerage industry. Goodness, my tongue's tangled all over there. So as these mortgage brokers disappeared, Greenspan at the time was looking at this and saying we separated from the self-interest of the investor at that point. In the past, if a bank was issuing a mortgage, there was a limited number of mortgages that they could issue. This goes way back. In that, if they gave Joe Smith a mortgage, that was a pretty good percentage of the deposits that they had on hand, if it's a small bank. Well, then if Joe Smith didn't pay that mortgage, then the bank was going to be in a lot of trouble. So over time, banks got together and other people got together to say, how do we diversify that risk? We don't want to have the whole bank fail because one person can't pay their mortgage or because 10 people can't pay their mortgage. So they said, all right, we'll diversify. I'm going to sell another bank part of this mortgage or the whole mortgage. And over time, the United States government said that's a need we have to fill, because if we're just spreading it around the small banks, if there's no big entity with deep pockets that's buying up loans, then you could have a domino effect where all the little banks go under at the same time. It's all the road is definitely being paved with good intentions all along the way. So Fannie Mae was created, or Freddie Mac, and the reality is that they were created separately, both times with influence from Congress, and were originally designed to compete against each other so that there wasn't one big entity. And then Congress passed another law that said, oh, that's too dog-eat-dog. This is too dangerous. One of them might fail. So now they don't have to compete with each other. In fact, they're kind of a monopoly in two forms because they can coordinate their prices. That was part of the problem in the recession, is that, no, the little banks didn't fall like dominoes. The big ones did. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had to go into receivership. The government had to step in and take over. The reason is because bad practices were everywhere. People were not checking to see if customers actually could afford the loan that they wanted. They were just looking at the commission that they would get paid. A lot of that fell on the shoulders of the mortgage brokers. Not all of it, by any stretch. There's a lot of blame to go around. Mortgage brokers, though, were being paid a lot. They didn't work for the bank. So if a bank was giving a loan, they're going to check really hard. They don't want to be left holding a mortgage that's not payable. Mortgage brokers got in, and the bonuses were huge. If you did enough loans, you could make a huge amount of money. I've got people in my family that were mortgage brokers. And then at the end of that chain, when the fault started laying out, when less loans were being given, the mortgage brokers couldn't make a living. They were part of the deal in that they would look around from bank to bank to bank and get them all to compete on an application that may not have been correct. So we still have some fundamental issues that haven't been fixed. We fixed some things, and that analysts are no longer allowed to blatantly lie about stocks that they're analyzing. And yes, that was a thing. They were allowed to say, you should buy this because we think it's great, when they were in the process of selling it. Talking the price up so that they could sell it to you. Dodd-Frank fixed that. So there were some good things in Dodd-Frank. Hold on, let me let my stomach settle down after saying that. Oof, all right. Yeah, there were some good things in Dodd-Frank. Not many. We had to do something, and that was what we did. And we did it in a timely manner. It was faster than we did in the Great Depression as a reaction to bad actors in the world. This is a statement, though, and it kind of goes back to what I was talking about before the break, when I was talking about the bear market, bull market, being to do with actual bears and bulls. And we have different kinds of bull markets and bear markets. We call them secular if they're really big, and we call them cyclical if they happen kind of regularly on a cycle. Well, what does secular mean? Secular is one of those words that it's Latin. It's one of those words that we use a lot in different contexts, and it sounds like it has a different meaning. When you're talking about a secular government, you're talking about a non-religious government. If you're talking about Iran, that is a non-secular government. It is run by clerics. It is a religious government. Iraq is a secular government, even though there's definitely religious components. We have religious components in our government. But we consider ourselves to be secular. Well, what does that mean? What does the word secular mean? The Latin for it means something like an age or a generation, the Greek aeon. It means once in a long period of time, a big event that may be based on a generation. When you're talking about a secular government, it has that same meaning. Because if you think about from the perspective of any religion out there, particularly ones that run governments, they say that their religion is forever. It's not generational. If you're going by a generational approach of these people are in power and other people will be in power later, that's called secular. When we're talking about bull markets or bear markets, when we talk about a secular bull or a secular bear, we're talking about a kind of a once-in-a-generation type event, a big one that has a lot more to do with the times themselves, the nature of the time, the zeitgeist, if you will. This is the spirit of a group of people. Then the secular, the cyclical bears or bulls, which are just based on normal market cycles. They're based on normal business cycles. You build up, you overbuild up. Oh, you got too much build up. Now you gotta eat some of your profit for a while because you've got too much in inventory. That's cyclical. And, you know, it's basically people are buying more. Let's make more. All right, they're still buying more. Let's make even more. And then you pass them up, and you're building more than they're buying. Well, now you're not making the profit that you expected to be because you spent too much on building up inventory. And that's kind of a normal cycle. When we have something like fundamental issues like what happened from the year 2000 or even 99 up through 2011 or so, that's called a secular. And it's got this component in it of euphoria, and we're immune to the problems of the past, and this is going to go on forever, rather than, oh, we messed up again, or, oh, we're doing good again. And that kind of gives some context, again, to political influence having less of an impact on that sort of situation. Politics was definitely involved. The loans that were given out were incentivized by the government. But they weren't incentivizing people to lie, except that people were lying and getting incentives. So everybody that got involved at the beginning had good intentions, and then slowly over time, those good intentions were tarnished. I'll buy a third house so I can flip it concept. But I'm going to say it's my primary residence. Who's going to be harmed by that? Well, long term, it's the majority of people that were harmed by that. Ethics isn't how much real harm happens when I throw this gum wrapper out the window. The question should be, what happens if everybody does it? And if everybody does it and it's bad, then you shouldn't do it either. There are times when that's not true, when everybody's doing a bad thing and you're doing something good. And that means if everybody does it and it's good, you should be doing it. Anyway, we're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour. I'll be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call off the air, we have voicemail waiting. We do give investment advice that's personalized to each individual, fiduciary investment advice. And that is local number 254-947-1111. You can reach that number toll-free, 1-800-914-PLAN. That's 800-914-7526. You can go to the webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email me directly at jake@tpwc.com.